You guys, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books was nominated for a Webby Award, which is this really prestigious award that I am dying to win. And there's a People's Voice component, and you can vote and get me from number two, second place, to first place. But you have to vote. Please go to vote.webbys.com. Vote.webbys.com, but it's kind of complicated, so it might be easier just to go to zibbyowens.com or my Instagram at zibbyowens, where it'll always be in my stories and it's in one of those little circle highlights. Please, please, please vote. Voting ends April 18th and I'm in second place, so please vote for best individual episode, talk show, interview show. Thank you so much.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Zibby Owens, and you're listening to the award-winning podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. I'm also the host of Moms Don't Have Time to Lose Weight, and I'm the editor of the anthology, which you should run out and buy, called Moms Don't Have Time To, a quarantine anthology. All proceeds of that book go to COVID-19 vaccine research. And I'm the editor-in-chief of Moms Don't Have Time to Write, a new publication on Medium, and we're accepting submissions, so please send your personal essays there. And if all that isn't enough, you can follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens, and my website is zibbyowens.com. Okay, now back to this amazing podcast. Jan Gru is the author of I Live a Life Like Yours, a memoir. Jan is the author of a wide-ranging body of work in fiction, nonfiction, children's books, and academic literature, and is a professor at the University of Oslo. I Live a Life Like Yours was published in 2018 in Norway, where it won the Norwegian Critics Prize for Literature and was nominated to the Nordic Council Literature Prize, the first Norwegian nonfiction book to be so honored in 50 years. It was translated into English. Welcome, Jan. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss I Live a Life Like Yours, a memoir.
Thank you. And the book is here now. So great.
Very exciting. You are such a beautiful writer. I mean, I'm sure you know this, but maybe it will be nice to hear. But like your prose, the way you write, it's so poetic and lyrical and just gorgeous. So I just wanted to start with that. I was so impressed and just kind of riveted and brought in by the style of your writing, not to mention your amazing story. So
thank you. Thank you so much.
Bravo for that. Would you mind telling listeners a little bit about your story and your memoir, why you wrote this and the main themes it was about?
Sure. I'll give it a try. So, I mean, probably the place to start is that I'm a wheelchair user and I was born with a muscular dystrophy. I remember a very happy childhood. I did have a very happy childhood. The reason why I wrote this book, I mean, I wrote it for, I think, nearly 10 years. It's one of those books that took a long time to find its shape. But the real sort of catalyzing event was a little while after I became a father, when my parents asked me whether I wanted to take over their archive, really, of papers from my childhood. And I said, yes. And my mother came by my office at the university with about 3 or 4 feet of paper. These were letters that they'd written, documents they'd saved, really everything that documented their interactions with doctors, with bureaucracies, really documenting all the work they had to do during my childhood. So I sat down and I read all those papers all the way through. And that was something of a shock, because that described a childhood very, very different from the one I remembered. That childhood was all about my diagnosis, my condition, my limitations, and really very poor prospects for the future. And so the book is really my attempt to try to reconcile those two stories, the one I remember and the one that, you know, the medical bureaucracy remembers. Very different stories.
Wow. That must have been, I feel like, how long did it take you to go through all those papers? I feel like they would have arrived on my desk and I would have stayed up for like 3 days trying to get through it all.
Yeah, I mean, it took a long while. And the strange thing is that I did remember some of the stuff in those papers, you know, visits to go and see doctors when I was very young, but also, you know, holidays where the wheelchair van never appeared, where nothing was as promised. And then, of course, the letters that, you know, the documented how my parents had tried to arrange things, had succeeded sometimes, had, you know, made their complaints afterwards. So I got to see really the story surrounding my childhood in many ways, and the way that the way that the world saw, well, me perhaps, and saw us as a family.
One of the most moving scenes was when you asked your parents, like, how was it for them as parents of you? Was it difficult? Was it, you know, and how they responded and how emotional and the struggle for, like, to capture it all. Like, tell me about that moment.
Yeah. No, I think the thing we had to sort of acknowledge to each other was that there was always something. And that something was an immense amount of work. And of course, you know this better than I do, but having children is a lot of work in any case. But what they faced was something different, because there was there were so many struggles with various agencies that were, you know, supposed to be there to help. And of course, they did help sometimes. But also there was this constant fight to claim our rights and to try and make things work and to try and secure a happy childhood for me and for my sister.
Wow. And even the image you start off in the beginning by saying how people you run into who you used to know as a child are like surprised that you're around. You know, I mean, that's like quite...
Yeah, I mean, that did happen to me quite a few times. And it was, I'm sure it was a strange experience for them as well. But for me, it was really an existential shock. So that was what people expected back then.
Wow. And the misdiagnosis, that was another like huge sort of, I feel, turning point. Like, what was that like, that you, your whole life, you had believed one thing and then suddenly it was disproven?
Yeah, I mean, that speaks to advances in medical science, right? Because the time I was first diagnosed, they were working from muscle biopsies and really very crude categories. And then, of course, came the age of genetic testing. And a lot of the old categories became broken up into hundreds of new ones. But yeah, I mean, that diagnosis was something I thought of as a pretty essential part of myself, with a poor prognosis and everything. And then discovering that this can't be right somehow. I mean, I was not expected to be able to walk at the age of 20. I'm still walking at the age of 40. And so at some point in my early 20s, you know, I realized that something was off in those projections. But it was a huge change and reorientation. It really was.
So when you were growing up, did you have like that your prognosis was going to be in your 20s in the back of your head all the time? Like, is that something you consciously thought about?
Yeah, I not necessarily consciously, but it was definitely something I felt and experienced. And I in the book, I talk about the sense of having not enough time, or knowing that the time is precious. And I think I probably have that in common with quite a few disabled people, feeling that intense need to prove myself. So then, of course, those two things were really tightly connected.
Wow. You know, there's this like distillation of life when you have suddenly some sort of set, you know, timeline affixed, right? Usually it's very unknown.
Yeah.
So what happens when you work backwards from that, and then it's like infinitely extended? Like, it's such an interesting question. Do you still feel like, because now like none of us knows our true diagnosis, right?
We don't. Of course.
Know. So how do you then live everyday life sort of in suspense of, I don't know. I mean, this is sort of a bigger question than the book, but it's, you know.
It is, but it also speaks to, I think, the immense power that diagnoses have over a lot of our lives. And these are, I mean, somatic or physical diagnoses, mental, psychiatric diagnoses, these have an incredible power of determination because they tell you what story you're supposed to live in.
Yes.
And that's not necessarily correct because diagnoses are incredibly crude in many ways. They can't capture very much about the life, and yet they hold this power over us.
True. It's like goes back to cognitive behavioral therapy, right? Where it's like your thoughts control your feelings, right? And if your thought is that this is fact, then you're gonna feel and act a certain way. But
yeah, and if somebody puts a label on you, then at some point you're going to have to, you know, relate to that.
But I loved how you sort of tracked the relationship of between you and your parents, and then of course you and your wife and your son, like over time, and how all of those are kind of like, you know, almost like a sine curve, like kind of waving up and down over time. And when you broke your ankle, how you had to move back in and they had to start the caregiving from scratch, and how demoralizing that must have felt to you. What was that period of time like?
Yeah, that was not a good time in my life. And that was felt like sort of the last and possibly lowest point before I would say things really turned around. I stayed in their house in my childhood home for about a month while recovering. And then after that, you know, it felt in one way like the only way to go was up. So I got a PhD fellowship. I started writing school and started writing things that some of them eventually made their way into this book. But it was a very strange time because it felt like one of those turning points where things could have also taken a turn for the worse. You never know. Yeah. And I know that, I mean, statistically speaking, I'm one of the exceptions. I mean, it's the numbers are terrible in Norway and in the US. It's something like one in 20 wheelchair users perhaps has a job.
Wow. Well, what we were saying a minute or two ago about time, and sorry, I'm flipping through because there were so many quotes and I just want to make sure I'm trying to give a sense of how amazing your writing is. But this is your experience with being a father, but there's more quotes you have on time, which are amazing. But you said, time with an infant is pure kairos. I am writing after 1.5 years as a father. It is a long now. The moment stretches out and swallows the horizon. I just kind of loved that because it's true. It's like the time sometimes feels completely endless. But this was, I think, my favorite part in the whole book when you gave a really vivid description of what it takes for you to get ready in the morning and how you have to allocate a lot of time. And you broke it down step by step on what your morning routine has become and everything. And you said, I cannot hurry. This is a sobering bit of evidence in my case and a crucial factor, a gigantic boulder in the middle of the road. I cannot hurry to the subway because my wheelchair can only go the speed that it goes. I cannot run. If I leave 5 minutes late from my home, I will arrive 5 minutes late at my destination. I cannot hurry to the bathroom. If I try to walk faster than my normal speed, I trip and fall. Time is inelastic. I require the time that I require. I just loved that. I mean,
thank you.
It's beautifully written, but just such an important message. I mean, sometimes you just have to, like, we all just, you require the time you require. It seems like so basic, and yet it's like a life-shifting philosophy, right?
Yeah, I'm really glad you picked out that passage because it's one of the things I really worked at, trying and give a sense of what the world looks like when you have a particular kind of body, when you have certain physical limitations. It changes everything. It changes your being in the world, and in doing so, it changes the world itself.
Wow. I remember, maybe this is like oversharing, but when I was nursing and, you know, you have to like pump for a certain amount of time, like when you're not with your kid, right? And
yeah.
I went to this wedding and I was like, well, I have to pump for 10 minutes so I can, like, you know, survive the rest of the night. So I go into like the wedding trailer right at the place and I start pumping and everyone starts banging on the door, right? Like now I'm causing this whole big line and I'm like, oh God, I need time to speed up. I need this 10 minutes to go faster. But then I was like, 10 minutes is going to be 10 minutes. Like no matter what I do, I cannot make this go any faster. So all I can do is change the way I think about it. But the more I like stress and sweat and like feel like all that anxiety, it's not making the time go any faster. So I don't know.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, grown-ups. The Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. So sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Today's episode has been sponsored by J. McLaughlin. J. McLaughlin is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with J. McLaughlin and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have J. McLaughlin stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through J. McLaughlin's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to J. McLaughlin's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern. And the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at J. McLaughlin. And so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. J. McLaughlin is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20, capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital Z Zibby 20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, J. McLaughlin. Thanks so much.
No, but I totally get that. I mean, they talked about this a lot with my wife, who's of course also a writer, and the experiences of her experience of pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. There's a lot there in terms of bodily vulnerability, and then that sense of just having to, in some cases, just surrender to those constraints, because there really is no other option.
Yeah, and I don't mean to elevate my silly nursing story to your, being in a wheelchair, but I think the point is that time is something we can't really mess with, even though we think we can.
And I think it's important to remember that even though one thing is not like the other, there are, points of connection, and those points of connection are incredibly important to remember. Also, because disability often gets very isolated as a topic, and we forget that it's really about, also aspects of human vulnerability that reach all of us in various forms.
Well, I think it's so easy for people to just be so afraid of the other, or right. It's like it's an admission to people, to themselves, that this could happen to them, and it's a reminder that I think people can't necessarily cope with sometimes certain people at least, and so the shorthand is not to deal with it at all.
Yeah.
Forget that. What do you mean? We're all the same. You're not different. I'm not different because I'm sitting down right now than I was 2 seconds ago and I was standing up. So anyway. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the philosopher Julia Kristeva talks about abjection, about that sort of intense fear and revulsion that you feel in yourself, but then you then project onto to someone else. And that someone else is often someone with a disability, with an illness, someone that you can really put all those, you know, scary feelings into.
Yeah, I have a very close friend with ALS. And, you know, over time, you know, she talks in a computer now with her eyes. And, you know, over time, her friends who visit have like dropped off, right? Like, and I don't go, you know, we don't live in the same place anymore. But, you know, it's so easy to just not pay the visit, right?
Yeah.
So easy to say like, no. But like, we have, like, nothing has changed. We have she's hilarious and amazing. Like, nothing's changed. And so I have the best time. Doesn't matter now. Anyway, so I feel sort of passionately about this whole thing, and, you know, and people being intolerant to anybody in any situation is just, you know, abhorrent to me. So anyway,
yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about the writing side of your life and your, you know, academia, which is so important to you, and like how you decided now's the time to sort of bring this book out into the world and all of that, how all of that sort of revolves in your life.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a strange journey too. I mean, I started out publishing some collections of short stories for an audience of like 4 readers, because that's what short stories are like these days. And they were mostly speculative fiction, which is, you know, science fiction without the hard math, which is good for me. But I still think I learned something from that, just in the sense of trying to imagine different worlds and different ways of looking at the world. And of course, as you pointed out, there's quite a lot about time in the book and the shape of time and different ways of experiencing time. And so I wrote some experimental fiction in that vein, dealing with those topics, and wrote a novel, and then started work on this book after that, when I felt that I'd maybe built up some experience with the craft of writing, because it felt like I needed that experience in order to deal with these topics. This was, you know, obviously a very important book for me to get right. But then it turned out that it became this strange mixture of different genres. I mean, one book that was really important to me in my writing was The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful, poetic, academic book about embodiment as well. And I learned from her that if I want to put academic references and academic quotes into a book that's supposed to be more poetic, then I can. I just need to select the right quote. Academia doesn't have to be dry. It doesn't have to create distance. If you find just the right observation, then it has, you know, all the power of good poetry.
Wow.
And I try to combine those things.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, I started off by saying it felt very much like a poem. It felt, you know, that's definitely the vibe it gives off to the reader, the lay reader, if you will. So what are you doing now? Like, do you want it, now that you have this out, what are you thinking next? Like, do you want to continue pursuing this type of writing? Do you want to continue sharing? Like, do you like having like a back and forth relationship with the reader versus putting, you know, how are you seeing your output sort of in the future?
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of time, I mean, I'm kind of speaking to you from 3 years in the future, because my book came out in Norwegian in 2018.
Oh, okay.
So it's so the translation takes time. So it's since the book came out in Norway, I had a lot of really interesting conversations with readers, letters, messages, and it was really a wonderful process. And then I wound up writing a new book, which is coincidentally out in Norway this week.
Oh, no way. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, no, it's really, really, really true. And then this new book is, I would say, almost a counter book and a more political book, dealing with different stories about disability. So yeah, I mean, I'm definitely going to continue in this vein, and I'm drawing on US disability studies in my work and in my writing. And Norway is an interesting contrast, because I mean, we have a wonderful welfare state compared with you guys. We have not had all of the I would say cultural space to think and talk about disability that the US has had. And that's one of the reasons why I bring California and Berkeley and the Bay Area into the book, because I learned so much from people working there. Mm. But that cultural moment seems to be happening in Norway these days. So a lot of disabled people are entering into the public sphere, and the conversation seems to be changing in many ways. And it's a very interesting moment to be a part of.
Here too. I mean, in the United States. I mean, I also recently interviewed a woman named Mallory Wegeman, who is in a wheelchair because of she went and got a shot from a doctor and it paralyzed her when she was training for the Olympics. And now she's actually a Paralympic, you know, gold medalist and all this stuff. And she wrote a book called Limitless. But a lot of the themes are the same in terms, you know, overcoming and what you have to, you know. But her message was so positive. Not to say yours is not. I just mean, like, her message was like, she's like, I was meant to be here because I need to tell everybody all of this stuff. Anyway, you should read it. It's really good.
Absolutely. I will.
And if you want me to connect you, I'd be happy to put you guys in touch. Maybe you could do an event together or something really cool.
Great. Yeah.
She's a wonderful, she's really great. And my husband's now actually helping with her documentary because he's a producer. So anyway, she's great.
Wonderful.
So I noticed in the New York Times review of your book that people are calling attention to your dressing style. How did you feel about that? Did it make, yeah, how did you feel?
Yeah, no, it's you know? Well, it's gratifying. No, I mean, I do make a point of it. And I do make a point of it because I think it's something that, again, a lot of disabled people have experience with, that you really need to think about your appearance. Because it's so easy to become discredited if anything is off. You know, there are a lot of people who are wheelchair users who are also homeless. And so you get a stereotype. And so you get stigma. And it becomes, you know, quite important to navigate that stigma in different ways. It's that thing of, so Rosemary Garland-Thompson, the disability scholar, talks about this a lot in her wonderful book called Staring, How We Look. About how being a staree, someone who it's, you know, socially legitimate to stare at, that person will always be conscious of being the object of other people's stares and will have to negotiate in that in some way. Mm-hmm. And so for me, you know, thinking about clothes and trying to find clothes that actually fit me, which is it's not an easy task, became something that I wanted to bring into the book as a way of talking about, you know, looks, appearances, and all of those negotiations as well.
I wonder if in the book Stare, they talk about fame, because that's another reason why people stare at people, right? It's, you can look different or you can just be so well known. I wonder if the effect on the staree is the same, sort of for different reasons, yeah?
Yeah, that's an interesting, I mean, I'm not trying to come off as horrible here, but I have been picked out on the street for having written books, for having appeared in the media. And so now I never know, you know, it could be that kind of attention. It could be the other kind of attention. I can't be sure. And it's an interesting kind of ambiguity to live with these days for, you know, however long this sort of micro celebrity in Norway lasts.
Yeah. No, because I feel like here, you know, people give celebrities a really hard time. Like, oh yeah, it's hard for you. I'm really sorry. Cry me a river, you know, but there is something to not being able to sort of move through the world in a yeah. way that, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a celebrity. I have no idea, but anyway,
I can imagine. I mean, in my case, it felt like I'm going to get people's attention, whatever I do. So it may as well be positive attention, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for you, go, you know, milk it. Why not? It's great. Sure. Do you have any advice for aspiring authors?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question, right? I mean, and the answer is always, you know, simple and incredibly difficult. It's to write. I mean, for me, the transformative year was a writing school here in Oslo, where I had to write stuff I would never have written on my own. To just try everything, different voices, different angles, different genres, different, you know, exercises, and then discovering my voice along the way. I'd written a lot of academic texts before, but this was something completely different. And I discovered that writing in a different way will also sometimes allow you to write about different topics. I mean, it's really a sort of a process of discovering what is within you.
Wow, that's great. Well, Jan, thank you so much. This was so interesting. And again, your book was absolutely beautiful. And I just thank you for spending the time with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently, so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.